have one case on our docket for oral argument this afternoon, and then we will be in recess for a panel change, and we have another case set for oral argument at 2:30. So your panel today is, to my right, Justice Bob McCoy. To my left, Justice Lee Gabriel. I'm Sue Walker. And we are ready to hear your arguments if you are ready to proceed. Are we ready?
We're ready, yes.
All right. If our clerk will call the case, we will get going.
The court will now call in the interest of S.I.-M.G. et al. The children versus Denton. And may it please the court, Mr. William Trenton to argue for the appellant, Mr. Matthew Williams to argue for the appellant.
Thank you. Mr. Trenton?
I'm going to do this when I'm here with the sons of my contemporaries, I can assure you. This is a case arising out of a suit on it's a child sold by CPS, and it raises some kind of interesting issues, I thought. I've kind of laid them out. They're kind of simple. I'll go through what really the mat's got a lot of detail in it, and if you've read the detail. This case started out with a woman who, his father was a lawyer, got involved with drugs, was addicted to Xanax and hydrocodone. She had gotten in trouble in Dallas with an insane baby daddy some years ago, was on probation out of Dallas, was at some point her second baby daddy for, I think we've got that one down as SBGR. That was a second father, and he was apparently involved in peddling of heroin. He was arrested there at their apartment. That brought CPS back in the case. The probation department from Denton County ordered up a deep screen hair follicle test. It proved that she was on the Xanax, the hydrocodone, and also there was a trace of heroin found in it. So there was a motion to revoke her probation. She was, during the middle of all this, she was arrested, taken to Dallas, put on to SAFE-P, the Supervised Adult Felony Probation Program, went to Dayton, Texas for that program for a year. She was released in December of 2012 and went to a halfway house at Salvation Army in Dallas. During the trial of this, she was still at the Salvation Army. So it was a very interesting case. There's two different fathers. Now, the father for the oldest child, that would be SIMG, that would be the oldest child. He was terminated in 2009, so he was not involved in any way in this case. We tried this to a jury, went on for 8.5 days. The jury was out about 7 hours deliberating. I brought a couple of issues that I thought were important. The lack of any instruction on wealth as a matter of what's in the best interest of a child. The Constitution of the United States, State of Texas, says that we have to have the equal protection of the laws. The United States Supreme Court, in a case called Tate versus Short in 1970, made a ruling that under the equal protection of the laws, you couldn't keep someone in jail if they didn't have any money, because if they had money, they wouldn't be in jail. It's my feeling that the same thing applies with this. The transcript of this hearing will show that throughout there was repeated reviews that the mother did not have a place to stay, that she couldn't send the child to summer camp, that various things could not happen. So I asked the court to give an instruction that the jury should not consider the relative wealth of these parties in making a decision on what is in the best interest of the child. I think that's backed up by the Supreme Court's opinion in Tate versus Short, at least in theory. So I brought that to the court's attention. Curiously enough, and I believe it's in the transcript, we missed the thing getting into evidence. The judge took it, everybody marked it and everything, and then we came around and we later filed a motion with the court to supplement it with this, and everybody says, oh, yeah, it's there, so y'all have that. And I think it's a reasonable instruction that should have been given. The other part of this, the jury was given questions 5 and 6 about the youngest daughter. The youngest daughter was born at the hospital there in Denton, normal delivery, but she was addicted to Xanax and hydrocodone, all of which were prescribed by doctors. The state had asked for an instruction under, let's see which one it was. The state was under the Family Code Chapter 161.001-1R, which would have been a termination of a child that is born addicted to a drug other than a prescription drug. But there was no evidence that the child or the mother were either addicted to non-prescription drugs by a doctor's prescription. At one point in the testimony there, the mother tried to quit Xanax the week before the child was born, and it nearly killed her. We later found out that Xanax, if you're suddenly trying to withdraw from it, it's possible it'll kill you. It'd make a very good stock to buy if you want to repeat business, I can assure you that. But so she was weaned off the Xanax and all in safety, but there was no evidence to support that she was any drug that was not prescribed. So then they offered up their 5 and 6 questions here in the charge, which had to do with her exposing the child in some way to these various drugs. And there's no evidence of that because the child was taken immediately by the hospital. Mother had no contact with her. The child was...
Isn't prescription drug use during pregnancy enough to support a 161.1E ground for termination?
No. It's 161.1R says unless it's if it's other than by a prescription drug.
I know, but my question is under 161.001-1E endangerment grounds because the parent's conduct...
I don't believe so. The difference is what she had the ability to do after the child was born was entirely out of her hands. She could have nothing to do with it. It was all done by prescription. And her prior to the birth, she was under the care of an obstetrician who kept her on those drugs, said if we take you off these drugs, that you're going to miscarry and the baby's going to die. So that's how that happened. So then afterwards, she had no control over any of it. So the difference between when you're a fetus, I guess, and when you're a born child, she had nothing to do with it as far as the youngest child when she was born, okay? So I don't think it would apply.
I think there's case law out of this court specifically in the interest of VR that holds that prescription drug use during pregnancy when you've obtained the prescriptions under false pretenses and taken the drug while pregnant.
Oh, I would agree with that, yes, but these weren't obtained under false pretenses. These were all prescription drugs as prescribed by the doctor. They had to keep giving her these drugs to prevent a miscarriage. She had the choice. The doctor told her early on. I'm sorry, I'll digress from what's probably in the deal here, but it's in there in the record. She was told that she was going to have problems, that she couldn't just quit using these drugs. She had to continue, or the child would miscarry, or she would have to get an abortion. So she had three choices. It was either if she quit doing the drugs, the child was going to miscarry, or she'd have to get an abortion, or carry the child to term.
So your position is, or the record shows that she was on a prescription drug before she got pregnant. She was prescribed these drugs, and so
yes.
Then the doctor elected to continue them.
She didn't realize she was pregnant for 2.5 months. Went to the doctor, and he says, you're pregnant. And she said, well, I need to get off these drugs. He says, it can't happen. And so they kept her on it. When she did attempt to do it, she was hauled to the hospital, emergency condition. I'm surprised she survived. And 7 days later, the baby was born. It was, of course, born addicted. Was given... Yeah, the stuff they gave you for heroin for several weeks. And then, of course, between the time the child was taken to the hospital and the time the child was weaned off, my client had been arrested and taken to Dallas County. So I would agree with you that she'd gotten it by false pretext or loaded up with more and all this other stuff. But there's no evidence that any of that occurred, particularly since it was all done by the same doctor and prescription.
Thank you.
Okay. The other problem that I've raised in this, or another problem, is the duties of the attorney ad litem. It struck me as fundamentally unfair, and it still does strike me as fundamentally unfair. An attorney ad litem was appointed, and the attorney ad litem interviewed the older daughter, which would be SIMG. And the child is very bright. All the testimony, she's very, very bright, very articulate. Asks penetrating questions, knows what's going on. But the child said, I want to be with my mother. The guardian ad litem filed a lawsuit on behalf of I keep wanting to say the names of these kids. This got me. On behalf of this SIMG, and we had her do a little video for the jury to say, very cute child, very smart. And I asked her, I said, well, did you tell your lawyer that you wanted your mother's rights to be terminated? And she said, no. I said, how does that make you feel? And she said, it hurts me really bad that someone would do that. So the lawyers have got to be appointed in these things as a matter of due process. I don't think you can take a child, the state can't take a child without the child having an attorney, without the parents having an attorney. It's just due process requires it because it's such an extreme remedy. But how can you have an attorney appointed who decides, well, I think it's better because these folks over here can afford to send the child to summer camp, for instance, is in there. The mother couldn't afford to send the child to summer camp. So this is a reason to terminate the parental-child relationship. Poor people don't get treated very well, you know, in the law. It just creeps in there. And I understand that they want to do the best interest of the child. But this attorney is supposed to be representing the child. The child's old enough to know what she wants. She still does, as a matter of fact. But the attorney says, nope, we're not doing that. And argued to the jury, you know, best interest of the child. And even though the child says she wants to see her mother, the best interest is, and I tell you to terminate. I don't think that, and I don't think the statute's unconstitutional, by the way, that she's appointed her. I can see cases where it would fit right in. But when you have a contested one where you have a 9.5-year-old child who can articulate what she wants, then the attorney, to be an attorney, has got to represent that client. And that's not what happened here at all. I think that's a major, major, major problem here. What else was in here? There was also an issue of whether or not she was performing the services necessary to get the child back and whether or not that was a violation and used to terminate. There's an order saying, because of the problem with being in the Safe P program, which, by the way, I hardly endorse. I had never been around it until I was in this case, and I'm very impressed with it, the people particularly. The order says that it's suspended until she finishes the Safe P program. At the time of trial, she was still in the Safe P program, but they still nevertheless said, well, she hadn't completed all her work, even though we have the order saying it's suspended. So I don't think there's enough evidence there to use that as grounds of termination because it's been suspended. Parenthetically, she'll be out in 2 weeks, finally finished with Safe P. I'm pleased to tell you that she's sober, she's clean. She even cleaned her mother up, believe it or not. I never known her mother to be sober. She cleaned that up. So Safe P's done a lot of good for them. I think of this, the court ought to hold as insufficient evidence to sever the parent-child relationship with the youngest child. And the older child, that didn't challenge all the findings about, because there's these opinions about if the child is worried about the police coming to the house and stuff like that. But I think the child had effectively no attorney. And I think that so screws that up that this case should be reversed. I can't say there's going to be any harm in it if it is reversed. It's not one of those cases where you're trying to send back somebody who's not done what they're supposed to do. She did. I'm very proud of her. I knew her dad, by the way, there's reference here. He died of a heroin overdose. We were able to keep him sober for about the last 8 years of his life until one day he slid back. He was a good friend, pretty good lawyer, nice guy. Didn't make it, but I'm convinced that Ms. Gallo will. Thank you for your time.
May it please the court.
Before I begin, I would like to introduce our newest appellate attorney in Denton County. This is Laura Tomlin. So she's sitting with me to see what we're all about. This is a tragic case. The older daughter really is a beautiful, smart girl. So is the appellant, actually. But for a very, very, very serious drug problem, we probably wouldn't be in here today. I don't have a lot to add than what I've put in my brief. So, of course, I would welcome any questions, but I do want to hit on a couple of things.
Do you think that the evidence is sufficient to support the termination for failure to comply with the service plan ground?
I do, because she admitted that she hadn't completed everything, And the trial court stated on the record that the order, the modified service plan, was not intended to completely supplant the earlier service
but
plan.
But how could she complete it when she was in SAFE-P?
Well, what the trial court said what, and what in fact happened was, is when she got out of SAFE-P and went to the halfway house, she made no effort to comply, didn't ask about it, and really dropped the ball on the service plan. Regardless of whether the evidence is insufficient, though, I would agree with what you said earlier, which is that the evidence is sufficient, really, as to both children as to D&E. I do want to mention that the subsection R jury instruction was abandoned, or the department abandoned that question and did not proceed under that, and proceeded only under D and O. And the evidence was sufficient to show that she exposed the baby to drugs. There was actually evidence, this is something I disagree with counsel on, there was evidence that the appellant used illegal street drugs, specifically heroin. There was testimony, particularly powerful testimony, from one of the appellant's own witnesses, one of her sponsors, who said that appellant admitted to her that she had used heroin while she was pregnant. And as far as the older daughter goes, in my opinion, it stretched a credibility a little for the appellant to say at trial, and I suspect that the jury did not find it credible, when she said she didn't know that father was dealing drugs out of that apartment, especially given what we know that she was addicted to heroin. With respect to the relative wealth instruction, I do want to mention that the Tate case that appellant cites really isn't applicable to this case, because what we have here isn't just an issue of wealth, but an issue of stability of the home, which is, of course, one of the factors that we talk about when we're determining whether it's been in the best interest of the child, or children in this case, to terminate. And the thrust of the testimony, especially when it came up with regard to the appellant's lack of employment and things like that, was that she had no history of stability, and she has no ability to provide a stable, safe environment for her daughters. There was also testimony, even from the department's witnesses. Veronica Tackett testified, look, we don't just look at wealth. This is not something that we're looking at in a vacuum. It's part of the overall construct when we're looking at a best interest determination. With regard to the ad litem issue, the family code specifically addresses situations like the one we had here, where we have a young girl, she was 9 years old at the time of trial, who's very bright and articulate for a nine-year-old. Really, really a neat girl. But she's 9 years old. And when, as the ad litem investigated this case, as the record shows, and what this girl's testimony, what it reveals is that, of course, she loves her mom. Of course she's attached to mom. Of course she wants to see mom. But she even recognized, even this little girl recognizes that mom isn't the right place for her, not at the time of trial. She recognized that mom was putting her in a dangerous situation. And the family code specifically addresses this issue, where an attorney ad litem is representing a child, and that child can't fully articulate what's in her best interest, in this case, because she's 9 years old, and of course pulled in an extremely difficult direction for anybody, especially a nine-year-old girl who's been through all this. And what the family code says is the ad litem can and should determine what's in that child's best interests and pursue that course of action. That's what the ad litem did here. That's what our position is, and we really would submit to the court that nothing untoward was going on with the ad litem. That's just a complete disagreement we have.
Why did the ad litem file a petition to terminate when the department had already filed?
Your Honor, I wish I could answer that question. The trial court dismissed the suit. I'm not sure why she did that. I suspect that she, I don't want to speculate. I don't know why she did it. The trial court dismissed it, and so it's really not relevant to determining on appeal whether she acted appropriately in pursuing termination at the time of trial. And what the record does show is that she did investigate the case, and she did talk to the girl a lot and dealt with her. Does the court have any more questions for me? Right, well, thank you for your time, and the department prays that the trial court's judgment be affirmed. Thank you.
Rebuttal, Mr. Trantham?
I'll say a couple things. There's an order in the record where in order to have the mother appear at trial, it took an enormous amount of work. Judge Bailey basically signed an order, ordered me to serve it on everybody, that anyone that interfered with her coming to court or took any action because she was coming to court was going to be hauled in his courtroom and held in contempt, which I thought was kind of an interesting order. But we circulated that, and everybody, including the judge in Dallas, whose court it was out of, said, well, she's got to be up there at the trial. So that's how it happened. She was under very, very strict time limits in the SAFE-P operation. If you haven't been there, I urge you to go see it and meet the people, John Ross, Mike Storm, fantastic people. I wish their success rate was a lot higher. But they're very strict. And so it was impossible to do the stuff and as ordered because she had to be in Dallas, Texas, and she was ordered to be in Denton and Louisville and several other places to complete this stuff. And that's why we asked to suspend it until she was through a SAP. The judge granted that order. So I think the evidence is insufficient. As far as Matt's argument that this is all about stability and all that, I'm reminded of Oscar Wilde's famous statement that the law and all its majesty forbids rich and poor alike from sleeping under bridges and begging for bread in the streets. And that's what we're ineffectively doing here. We're calling in nice people, got plenty of money, telling people this is a good reason to terminate because mama's, got a problem. And I agree, mama's got a problem. But just because we got problems is not a reason to separate us from our kids, particularly when the child just didn't have a lawyer. And Judge Gabriel says, hi, why did she file this termination? File a motion on behalf of a child who did not authorize it, said it hurts me deeply. It's because she was motivated to do so. I know the motivation. I'll just tell you, she's very motivated to do it. Very, very, very motivated to do it. Didn't care. Wasn't listening to anything that the child was saying because she had her own agenda, and she played it out during the entire trial. I invite you to take a look at any of the arguments, any time she spoke. She had her own agenda. It was not the child's agenda. It wasn't what the child wanted. And the child is 9 years old. When you can articulate, I don't want you to terminate my mother's rights, that's a pretty good articulation of what the child wanted. It was totally ignored. Totally ignored. And I don't think that meets the requirements of due process. Maybe we need to do something. Maybe all your opinion say a lawyer's got to do something besides sit there and say, I'm a guardian ad litem now, or I'm able to determine this, or maybe there needs to be a hearing before the court to determine what the lawyer can do. I don't know. I don't know the answers to these things, and I know the court in Denton County didn't know the answer. So y'all give us an answer, and we'll be out of your hair. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Counsel, thank you for your arguments. Ms. Tomlin, welcome to our court. We appreciate you being here. Your arguments have been helpful to the court. Your case is submitted, and we will be in recess until the next case for a panel change.
All rise.